ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik from Sweden. We hope you had a good week. The Yuletides are fast approaching, and we hope you will spend some good quality time with your family and connect with your roots, once again, the ancient roots of your ancestors. And of course, we hope that you spend some time with us as well. You can enjoy the free archives, or you can sign up for a membership at redeyesmembers.com and take the time to catch up on some of our over 900 shows waiting for you in our archives. We're also adding 3 new programs each week. We have another good one for you today. Our guest is Joaquin Flores. He is an American expat living in Belgrade, Serbia. He's a full-time analyst at the Center for Syncretic Studies, a public geostratic think tank. His expertise encompasses Eastern Europe, Eurasia, and he has a strong proficiency in Middle Eastern affairs. Flores is particularly adept at analyzing the psychology of the propaganda wars and cutting through the noise of information overload. He is a political scientist educated at California State University. In the U.S., he worked for a number of years as a labor union organizer, chief negotiator, and strategist for a major trade union federation. He presently serves as the Europe-wide coordinator for New Resistance, a U.S.-based revolutionary movement. Our focus today is going to be on how to bridge the values from the old left and the new right, and how a false polarization of the left and right has occurred when actually a lot of interests are commonly shared. We'll talk about what needs to happen in order for us to move beyond the political cesspool of little to no options, and how to implement a political system that actually caters to the needs of the people as opposed to the establishment. And this includes the banks, the cultural Marxists, and the market manipulators. Hey, welcome, Joaquin. Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's great to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. It's going to be really exciting. I think you're part of some of those new interesting groups, I guess, projects that are popping up that are actually truly crossing some of the old left and right political boundaries, and some really new exciting ideas are springing out from projects and organizations such as those that you're involved in. I definitely want to talk more about those later, but I happen to know you're in Belgrade, the white city. I was actually there myself in 2009, a lovely city in Serbia, of course. Tell us how you ended up there, being from L.A. originally.
Right. Well, as you said, I'm from L.A. I'm living now in Belgrade. And what happened basically is by way of education, I'm a geostrategist and political scientist. And I decided I wanted to be right in the middle of the action moving forward. And so around 2009, I could see, or 2008, 2009, my analysis led me to believe that the conflicts in the Middle East were going to be drawing in the Russians more and more into a larger conflict, and that of course historically, for those of us who know about World War I, World War II, and the war in 1990s in the Balkans, the Third Balkans War, that the NATO was deeply involved, of course, in kicking events off in the Balkans. And, of course, both Europe and Russia and the Ottomans, you know, struggled for hegemony in the Balkans. And based upon the direction of trade, you know, energy markets, the direction of the EU, I could see that this part of the world was going to figure crucially in the coming years. And on a personal note, Henrik, actually, it also got to be a stage in my life where I found that I didn't want to work and live in a country where, you know, half of my tax dollars was going to support this giant military industrial machine that was, you know, quite literally dropping bombs on innocent people and women and children, and of course the torture system. And it just got to be, I just morally just couldn't justify working, living, and paying taxes in the United States anymore.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good reason, and actually some of those things you've mentioned there are things we can return to a little bit later. I think the Balkans, as you say, is an extremely important region. A lot of different geopolitical strategists have understood this, of course, not the least one of the reasons why NATO has gotten in there and tried to establish a permanent hold on the region. So there's definitely some interesting stuff there. But before we get deeper into some of these things, just tell us a little bit more. You're part of a couple of different groups or projects, whatever you want to call them, think tanks, that I want to kind of just run through here. But tell us about CSS Center for Syncretic Studies first.
Yeah, the Center for Syncretic Studies was founded after a white paper that was produced in 2010, which saw the changing ideological developments and range sphere of politics and philosophy, that intersection, that were happening in Russia in the post-communist world, rather, and then also looking at the direction that the radical movements in the U.S. were taking, in particular in relation to the development of communist, socialist, anarchist groups on the left in the U.S., and also with the militia movement, constitutionalist groups, and libertarian movements, which might be termed on the right in the U.S., and looking at where these were going. And so there was a need, we felt, to develop something out of this and to sort of bridge the gap and look at that in a broader lens.
Well, that's very very interesting. I think that's part of where I'd like to spend some time, I guess, first out of the gates here, really, and just kind of discuss some of the differences between the political divide that has occurred, these old, you know, groupings, I guess, of the political spectrum of left and right. I've said for a long time that these are they aren't what they used to be, and there's certain things that have shown that this is, you know, not so. Specifically, when you look at things like, I guess, Israel and allegiance to Israel in this picture and what have you, and that you know, classical right or classical left doesn't apply anymore. But I think you're coming from this from a perspective where you've also been looking at how do we bridge these two? How do we look at the common interests of what both of these different ideologies want to try to have achieved? What are some of the main cores, and how do we get those to begin to cooperate as opposed to being completely divided on this issue? How do you view this question?
Well, I view the question in terms of course in the purely world of ideas and language, words, and psychologically what people's wants and needs and desires and dreams are. And then on the practical end, what are the changes that have happened technologically over the past 10 and 15 years of development and access to high-speed internet, and how it is that people who in the past, say, for example, I will sketch out, you might be someone living in a state like Illinois or Tennessee or Alabama, and in the past you would have met people on the ground in real life, maybe through work or at university, and then you would have begun to receive a newsletter, like from the John Birch Society or Ron Paul's newsletter. And this was pretty much your access and interaction to the world. And, of course, there were mainstream texts that one could get from the library. One could watch maybe public television, KCET in the United States, to get maybe more of a broader view, or, you know, somewhat, or sometimes they would give access to BBC, which in the 80s and 90s was a little bit more balanced than it is today. And outside of that, that was people's exposure to the rest of the world, right? And then, of course, with the Internet, and I know I'm saying something that everybody already knows, people who had certain set of ideas were able to gain access to other total universe of ideas, and people started to kind of put pieces together on their own, and people started to already see that things that they thought were true also were believed by other people who they thought didn't share anything at all. And what people started to find was that there was a lot more commonality, and all we've tried to do is help to present a language and a process by which this process, this organic and natural, technologically driven process, can be completed.
How would you say that this have changed the political landscape, if I can put it that way? I mean, the more people are getting access to information, which means that they learn more not only about what they themselves, you know, think and what opinions they hold, they learn about themselves, but also their political enemies, I guess, and this people become, of course, more you know, hardened in their opinions, and in some cases, rightly so. You know, this is just how it's changing the landscape. And I think that we're coming into a time now, politically, where I think we've never been here in the history of the world, considering how much information we have available. And I've just been puzzled by this concept of the more, you know, different and to a certain extent isolated people become in their own political bubbles. It's amazing that the political systems we have are trying to cater to all these different needs that are out there. This is just crazy to me. How do you view this?
Yeah, I agree, and it is crazy. And what we have found is that in the United States, people don't like the Democrat Party or the Republican Party, and that's just looking at the sort of banal, narrow view of political parties. But even here, we can see some great truths exposed. There are a number of pretty great polls that have been conducted. For example, Reuters conducted a scientific poll last month at the beginning of November and had over 9,000 people that they asked, which is 900% more than the required minimum 1,050 or 1,090 persons required for a scientific poll of this scope, on the question of would you like to see your state peacefully leave the United States and end its relationship with the federal government. And a full 25% or one out of four Americans who were of voting age between the age of 18 and upwards to whatever, 80 or 90 years old, I suppose, agreed that they wanted this. So that's 25% of the population, and that's in a poll, you know, that was asked under certain conditions, people who they could reach. I don't know methodologically if they only called landlines. If it didn't involve cell phones, I would imagine that number would be significantly higher, perhaps 10% or 20% higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, well, basically, you already have this sort of thing where people don't want to be part of the United States. Furthermore, another poll, and this is, these are just the numbers to kind of lay the foundation of what we're talking about. We're not imagining these things. Another poll conducted scientifically by Zogby, I believe it was Zogby, found that 11% of Americans support communism politically and economically over the present system. Another 36% of Americans support socialism, and 44% of Americans support libertarianism or describe themselves as libertarians.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I think that, again, just going to reiterate that point, we're getting close to a time where we need more political diversity. And a lot of people have been talking about these, you know, murmurs, you know, coming from the bottom up, so to speak, that people, they are getting sick and tired of centralization. They're getting sick and tired of globalism, of capitalism. And you have so many things that have happened in our world. Consequently, we have, in some cases, forced mass immigration into countries, population movements. This is not only happening due to wars, and we can get into some of those reasons for that later, but it happens, in some cases voluntarily. People want to move, they uproot and go to different places. What do you think is the where is this going? Where is things leading to here, do you think, when so many things are changing so quickly, so drastically? Do you think we're going to get more of smaller states, of breakups happening where people are going to try to achieve to live more with those people they want to live with and, let's say, the political ideologies that they would like to see in the world? Because I don't see any other way out of the situation that we've worked ourselves into here. What do you think, Joaquin?
Yeah, in the United States, it is definitely the push must be towards decentralization. That's what people want. It makes most sense. And it also makes the most sense for businesses not to have regulations, interstate, federal laws, which inhibit their ability to make their own decisions. So I think there's a commonality which transcends class divide that would like to see a decentralization of federal power in the United States. And we already see naturally, and this is sort of a point which some on the left will need to come to understand and wrap their head around, is that in actual real existing communities that involve the working class and middle class, people tend to naturally gravitate to live in communities with people who remind them of other people in their families who have similar surnames or who look like them. And this is a human tendency. And it's something which perhaps have some elements of social construction involved. I mean, this is a debate, of course, in the sciences. But what is more important is that this is what people tend to do. For whatever reason, this is what people tend to do, and that is a fact. And we saw this already beginning in the United States in the 1950s and 60s with the white flight demographic trend, where working and middle class whites began to leave the urban centers after World War II, as African Americans began to leave the South in search of opportunities in industrial jobs, and at this time in history, there may have been some underlying racism and issues like that, but over time, and while race is still an issue, we have also found that African Americans prefer to live in communities composed primarily of African Americans. Asian Americans also prefer this, and so on and so forth. And so if people had choices and were not being driven by overarching economic concerns imposed on them, they would tend to live in communities that look like themselves. And there's it's hard to massage that in a politically correct way.
you don't have to do that here. No worries.
But there's nothing negative about this.
No one should be treated
unequally, and no one should be denied opportunities. And the people who are the most capable to do things should receive the opportunities to do them. And this doesn't contradict that at all. And expanding upon what we've seen in the United States, we can also extrapolate that in the rest of the world. People historically, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, there were, of course, always small groups of people who had that wanderlust, or they were engaged in certain types of mercantile trade, or they were scholars, or they were military, and so they traveled, and they may have settled down in other places, but after a few generations, you know, their children and their grandchildren became absorbed by the broader population, and so on. But today what we are seeing is not this natural type of human migration patterns, but we're seeing one driven intentionally, where we live in such a time where economic forces and technical forces are so well coordinated that whole populations can be scientifically targeted for removal, or scientifically targeted to be moved, relocated, and for one population to be pushed onto another population to create a divide and conquer situation.
I think it's a lot of negative side effects to this. We can get into the mechanics of this a little bit later and talk more about that. But I think, we can see even when economic circumstances are right or I guess wrong, depending on your perspective, people still try to achieve to live with people that they want to live with. And I think natural segregation, as you said, has occurred within American society. When you look at that, there's a natural state there. I mean, I think the melting pot is an artificially created phenomena. Even if you look at historically, as you said, these few, let's say, market centers that were in place where you had a kind of, initial early stage of multiculturalism, these were, to a large extent, temporary. People came and left. They still had their own, you know, homelands. It was a very few tribes that wandered in that capacity. But nonetheless, I think the point here being is that this is something that's artificially imposed. And it's kind of like, I think then we have to recognize that the natural state of things is how things have been historically. And I think anything that tries to change that picture is something we have to recognize as being artificially imposed upon us. In other words, I see it as a kind of a violence of sort, as a state tyrannical move, actually.
Yeah, it is a form of violence because people have a right to live in the lands where their grandfathers and great grandparents lived. It's a human right because it's works similar to inheritance, and these are people's real existing material and cultural inheritance. And all of the struggles that your parents and your great-grandparents and their parents and so forth made, every struggle they made was ultimately to provide a better life for their children and to provide a society and a culture for their children and their children's children. And so to deny that right is the same thing as sort of like a state coming in or a corporation coming in and forcing you out of your home. It's actually really the same thing morally, and it has the same effect politically and economically. So we can really actually draw an equal sign right there.
How do you think that this question, which is to some very sensitive, is something where there could be common agreement over? Because if we look at, for example, let's say European societies and look at the rise of the nationalist parties, I think that these are obviously occurring due to a reaction of the imposed forced migrations that have occurred on many of the Western European societies, and they are feeling something's changing here. It's changing too quick. You know, they feel that their right. culture and identity is being threatened, and again, rightly so. But how can there ever be, in your view, how can there ever be an understanding between the left and the right on this particular issue? Because I've always wondered, I mean, if someone yeah. wants to live in a multicultural, place, they're pushing it upon, some of these countries and others are not being forced to become multicultural. So who is to decide that, you know?
Right. That's a difficult question. But what we have found is that what's happening in the general trend is that in the discourse, and of course in Europe, has been somewhat staged, because what has happened is that the intelligence organizations have so fully infiltrated and been in control of both the mainstream political parties and in some cases the fringe political parties that they have been able to control the discourse. So they stage it in such a way that both the center-right Christian democratic type parties and the center-left social democratic and even Euro-communist type parties both had this sort of open view towards multiculturalism in different ways and expressed in different ways, but towards the same goal. And the only groups that they created this kind of strange space for to express concerns about immigration were these sort of neo-Nazi or pseudo-Hitlerian type formations, which I think that we've all been programmed, or we have all understood to view very negatively. And I don't think there's any getting around that. This is just a fact that we have to deal with, that groups that openly identify with, say, Adolf Hitler, right, aren't going to be too popular or gain too much traction.
Right.
But yet those are the groups that in the early stage of the new phase of globalization, say in the late 80s and early 90s, were the ones who really were showing that there was a demographic problem. Fortunately, a lot of this tendency and this trend has transformed, and the internet, like I said, has allowed people who were into this stuff to read other materials, and also new adherents and people attracted to this nationalist politics have brought with them their other ideas and their travels and their exposure to the world with them. And so what we have seen is a trend against supremacist views, and we have seen that nationalist groups in Europe have abandoned and moved away from neo-Nazism and instead have said, look, there is a problem where European colonialism, not European people, but we're talking about the ruling class, created economic conditions in their colonies which then pushed these migrants into Europe, and for Asians to stay primarily where they would like to stay, and for Africans to stay primarily where they would like to stay, means that an economic system which allows Asia for Asians, Africa for Africans, would have to exist in order for Europe to be for Europeans.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. It's a lot of upheaval here, of course, and just a quick comment on what you said previously. Let's take the Swedish Democrats, Sweden, the country that I'm from, who allegedly, so they say at least, have their roots in neo-Nazi groups, etc. Much as the left party in Sweden had their roots in hardcore communism and, right. big Lenin and Stalin fans and what have you. But nonetheless, they've, as you said, they've more kind of moved away from this, obviously. But the difference here, I think, is that in the case of Sweden Democrats, and I think it's true with most other nationalist parties in Europe that are on the rise right now, they are practically the only party that are addressing this issue. I mean, we don't have to get too specialized about Sweden, because that's a very different case. The political correctness is so crippling there, and the refusal to address the migration issue is just, I think, on par with no other country in Europe right now. So it is a little bit special, but nonetheless, my point being, if they are the only party that is addressing this, then everyone who sees this question as fairly central in the political debate are going to seek themselves towards parties like this, which is very understandable, and I completely agree with it. They're also right. the only parties that are trying to get us out of the European Union, for example.
That's right. And so then to tie up your question, is on this basis that the left can be approached and the left can understand. And, of course, we're talking about the working class and middle class, hard left, those who in Europe would be also Euroskeptics and who also would see that the problem is the rule by the big banks, corporations, I put in scare quotes, capitalism, and of course imperialism. And I think that the new nationalism and a type of a new old left, if I make any sense there, can come together, right, and can push aside the new left and the neo-Nazis completely, create a new pole, which is like a radical center, which embodies all of the real hopes, dreams, wants, desires, and needs of Europeans. And, of course, they're different in Italy from Spain and Germany from France. And I think that also speaks to the profound problem with the EU and how power in Brussels needs to decentralize. But moving to where New Resistance and our group is more interested, of course, in developments in the U.S., we can look at Europe. And what we found is that in the 2012 elections, we found that many Democrats were voting for Ron Paul after 4 years of Obama,
yeah,
who basically lied his way to get elected. And Obama delivered absolutely none of the things which he promised. And Obama attracted many Republican voters in the first place because of his anti-imperial stance and because of his promise to create reindustrialize the U.S. and so working in middle class and small business people who traditionally voted Republican, the so-called swing voters in the swing states, went over and voted for Obama. And all of these swing voters, plus whole swaths of the anti-imperialist left, went ahead and voted for Ron Paul. And so we could already see that the party system is on a very, very unstable footing and could really be toppled over under the right conditions.
Well, you know, I know that Europe, of course, can formulate new parties, and in some cases they can be actually very successful pretty quick out the gates. Again, just going back to Sweden Democrats, they got into parliament in first time the election 2004, I believe, and now basically they're the third biggest party, which is a huge advance such a short time. But in America, that's a very different situation because you can't just go set up a new party and become established in a couple of years. It seems like a deadlock there. So how the heck is that going to happen, do you think, the political reformation of that system?
Yeah, it's the problem with the United States is that, of course, as you mentioned, we have a winner-take-all electoral system. And on top of that, at least until the 1970s or so, there were visibly two parties. And in foreign policy, there were distinctly two parties. And on national policy, there were two parties. And the foreign policy and national policy roughly could be said to be Democrat and Republican. But by the time of the rise of Clinton, we really saw the end of trilateral foreign policy, of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the stagnation of the Japanese economy and the increase of the role of Central and Eastern European states being incorporated into NATO. We saw really kind of an end to trilateralism and a move towards the unilateralism, which has been, I guess we could call, the neocons. But, of course, the neocons are not Republicans. They're Democrats and Republicans. And, of course, we know Obama has staffed up to his ears his administration with these so-called neocons, including Kagan and Nuland. And so we can look at this and see that the U.S. is a monolithic power. It does not have the room politically to be reformed. So that is really catastrophic and unfortunate for Americans because they're going to have to brace themselves for a political collapse and an economic collapse, but not one they should be afraid of, but rather they should embrace. They can make the right preparations and begin to build their communities and begin to create alternative states, or rather a condition of dual power, to borrow from Lenin, where people can start to build business communities and political networks and plans for new currencies within different regions of the United States. Nothing is stopping them. They can go ahead and do this now. And There are already examples in certain small communities of people starting to issue and create their own currencies. And people are using things, and we can already see that this is not like science fiction. We can already see that through Craigslist and eBay, people are engaging in barter-type economies, and people are already starting to reject buying new things, and they're just trading things they already have. More and more people are growing their own food, so on and so forth. People are pulling their children out of schools and looking at the Montessori program, or they're looking at homeschooling or their own institutions that they're building on the community level.
Yeah, they're trying to get out, do it on their own, and get accustomed to that before it's too late as well, perhaps. But
yes.
It's almost like secession then seems to be one of the more plausible way out of the American empire, correct?
Yes, it is, and it will. There will be, and we have seen. This is why we think, you know, we're looking at stats that mainstream polling, scientific polling institutions have put out. You know, we don't produce our own numbers. We don't have the capacity to do so, and it wouldn't be very convincing for us to produce our own numbers. These numbers that show that at least a quarter of Americans want out of the U.S., want their states to secede, was done again by Reuters, which is one of the top three or four major news and information collecting services in the U.S. Almost all news that Americans receive comes from either Reuters or AFP. Or AP, rather.
Yeah.
And so the Reuters poll should be taken as gospel, and if anything, it underrepresents that figure. So it could be a very conservative figure. And indeed, so moving forward, that means that we would look at what are the basic demographic, ethnic, language groups in the U.S., what are their histories, what are the sort of potential for industrial or deindustrialized production, how can so-called green but really stable types of technology can be developed to get away from the toxins and pollutants. And these are the things that can't happen at the federal level. And we are in the United States, there's a crisis of leadership, really, Henrik, because the issue is that the people in power are so far removed from the experiences and the lived lives of everyday people that they can't fathom that these things are really problems, and they're just so far removed. You know, it's what has really happened to kind of answer your question, which is a profound one that you've asked, and to really get at the root of that problem, you see, is that the American political system has really... If it ever was, it has moved away from a meritocratic framework and has really been built up by the types of people in corporate culture who were the yes men. And yes men, as you know, have certain tendencies. And these are the most pronounced features of American leadership. And so they are actually very disconnected. They actually don't understand what it means when they look at figures relating to poverty, unemployment, healthcare. It's almost like they have Asperger's or something, and they don't quite understand that this relates to real people who are going to do something about it.
These are just numbers on a paper, really. How do we, you know, how do we get the polls up, right? I mean, they look down from their ivory towers, fly over the cities in their private jets, and live in their gated communities while they push, you know, multiculturalism, and don't realize what the inflictions are in these transitional neighborhoods and the conflict that comes with these cultural clashes that we, for example, see. So, I mean,
right.
Of course, what the people want is not something that I think voluntarily ever will be fulfilled by the financial or the political elite in America. And on top of that, problematically, you have, just as you kind of said in the beginning, the how much of the budget of America goes into the war. You have neocon or AIPAC grip on American foreign policy. So there's tons of issues here that just needs to kind of be solved in some way, but I guess your point being that this is going to come organically out of a collapse of the system, be that financial or political. Is that right?
That is right. That is right. And so people need to already be building their communities, poles of resistance. And this is not to like hyperventilate on it. People don't need to build like underground bunkers or, you know,
right,
start saving. You know, I know that there is some relevance to the prepping community, and there are some good lessons to be learned. But you know, it's really about you have to look at the resources where you live and how food can be grown and where power sources can come from. And the thing is that the United States is going to collapse, but the rest of the world is not going to collapse. And so what Americans also need to understand is that the world is not America. And just because the U.S. could go towards a Mad Max type scenario does not mean that China or Russia or Iran is destabilizing. And so actually, some of these forces can actually help stabilize the situation in the United States. That means, for example, if the Pacific Northwest of the United States were to secede from the Union, they'd immediately, they're geographically close to Japan and Russia, and relatively speaking, in terms of freighter transport, and they'd be able to make their own trade deals and begin their own infrastructure and development programs immediately with Russia and Japan and perhaps China as well. And they would be able to, they're right there with Canada, and same things that are happening in the U.S. will be happening in Canada. As you know, 80 or 90% of Canadians live within 200 miles of the U.S. border, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So is this one of the reasons why you wanted to get out of the U.S. as well, or that you feel that this is something that's looming and it could potentially become somewhat volatile in that destabilized period?
Well, I knew that, it would go in that direction. It's really not the main reason I left. I personally, and I don't know if this is great for the show format, but if I can say on a personal note that I was involved in very radical left-wing groups throughout the 90s and early 2000s, and I have, issues, let's say, with the state and the FBI and so forth, and I'm not trying to be paranoid about it, but I've been visited more than once, and I just felt like it was going to create a problem moving forward, looking at the types of things that they are doing to people in the U.S. and the rest of the world. I knew that people like myself and others who've been actively involved in this would likely be targeted. And I didn't want to end up, it's my worst fears, of course, end up in some place like Guantanamo or something, but it's
right.
Something that U.S. is clearly going to be doing. And whether or not I really would be a candidate for that, it was really more I couldn't stand paying taxes and very high taxes for very low returns, and just morally, ethically, I also wanted Henrik to start a family, and there's a big problem in the U.S. with gender relations, family law.
It's really
foolish for a man in his 30s or 40s who's never been married before to think about getting married, knowing what he knows by that age. To marry in the United States is probably one of the most foolish things you could do.
Some of the issues you brought up, and I completely agree with you. I mean, look at how the West primarily has been transformed with state feminism. We've had, of course, cultural Marxism for a very long time. A lot of issues that have been plaguing everything that has to do with traditionalism, basically. But those are right. Things that are on the left, right? And you mentioned you came more from a left perspective initially. What made you transform and change politically and started looking at some of the arguments on the other side? That's always an interesting thing to ask about, I think.
Yeah, well, to be clear, my sense of justice and my values have not changed. And it really, I feel that it was the left that changed. And what I noticed beginning in the middle 90s, I'm almost 40 years old, in the middle 90s, I saw that there was a concerted effort, and it seemed very alien to us, that radical feminism was being made one of the primary agendas in groups that historically focused on issues relating to imperialism and the interests of the working class and labor unions. And the working class, of course, has an interest in imperialism, in curtailing it, but the gender thing just seems so very alien. And which is not to dismiss the real lived experiences of women, which is not to say anything about that, but that it was very alien from a working class perspective. And myself growing up, working class neighborhood, Los Angeles, and seeing that there were really these upper middle class people from the East Coast, let's call them that, from New York, moving to Los Angeles and trying to change what the left was focused on. And it you know, it created a situation where people were being qualified not by their ideas and not by their ability to be good organizers, but rather by their adherence to radical feminist dogma.
Interesting. Yeah, it's fascinating how this has been, you know, used in so many ways. We've done so many shows talking about this, and of course how this is something that is working against, well, you know, normal, regular people. It's become about issues of manipulation and conditioning, both psychologically, but also, you know, even how sexuality has been, you know, used against people and what have you. But it's interesting. I just want to hear a little bit more about your views on some of these things. What do you make of, let's say, free market within a country, let's say, that has broken off or what have you, their choice and their people agree to have, you know, let's say, low taxes and all these things. Is that something you're for?
Yeah, I'm for that. It has to be based upon the reality of the people who are living there and what their values are and how they want to live. You can't have free markets where you have monopolies. And we live in a period where technology has evolved either organically or intentionally in a direction which promoted production on mass scale. And production on mass scale would necessarily be under a single enterprise. The corrosive effects on human freedom were actually really identified not only by Adam Smith, but also by the Marxists and the anarchists. And of course, they proposed the model where the employees of these monopoly firms would be shareholders and would democratically control those institutions in order to meet the needs of people. But this technology kept evolving and it didn't produce opportunities for democratic management. But technology is also moving in a direction now with 3D printing and nanotechnology, where in the future people will be able to produce very highly sophisticated goods from their home. And people will be able to produce things and exchange them in a small business framework.
That's interesting. I've always been interested in how technology can solve some of these issues as well. I mean, just think of the potentiality with robots, for example, when it comes to solving both tedious but also really hard labor, for example. And I know that a lot of people on the left are against that. I know that, you know, a lot of the Luddites, they, you know, oh my God, is like when the first couple of sewing plants were started in France. I remember that they were burnt and vandalized because they were afraid that, you know, here's something that comes in that's going to make me lose my job, etc. And I know that that's kind of a default position by many on the left, but I've always said that, wait a minute, there's always going to be tons of different jobs to do. And as we solve one issue technologically, there's going to be new services, new industries, and new things on the horizon. And I was, to that extent, I guess I am I'm for that type of progress. I don't want to hold society back. And then at the same time, on top of that, I think that it's important to not let that, you know, rule society as we're heading now with transhumanism and all this nonsense, right? But I feel that there is a balance in between these things. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. And when you look at some of the ideas, you know, that I think that those on the right would need to examine in the economic theory or the sociological theories of Karl Marx would be how he looked at how technology was driving the changes in social formations, and that the increase in use of machines, what we would now call robots or automation, was decreasing the role of human labor and was going to create opportunities for goods and services to be delivered at lower and lower costs because of the reduction. Once the initial investment in the capital of the machines was paid off through sales, then you would see a diminishing cost of providing goods and services. And likewise, then that would free up human beings to engage, as you said, in ever more different and varied forms of productive labor in new pursuits in areas that we haven't even begun to imagine yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
The point is being that we have to take from all of these different schools, and we have to include everybody and all of the good ideas, and there's no one from the past who's had it 100% right. And you know, things I'm saying today will also be wrong. But the process and the conversation must involve taking, you know, and involving all these different people who the system has, you know, tribalized and compartmentalized into mutually hostile camps. And so we have to let go of certain terms and you know, divisive language and concepts which blame other people instead of the system, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. Would you say that that's been intentional with the dialect and to try to break it up in this capacity? And if so, is that due to the fact that it's beneficial to the ruling class?
Yeah, it's definitely to the elite, the ruling class, the oligarchs, however we want to call them. It's been to their benefit, and what they have done is they've manipulated human tendencies to be tribal, and humans are naturally tribal, but they can also think in big terms, and they can also think in terms of really big tribes. And another way of tribal thinking is in us and them, which is natural, is to think of bad ideas as being the them, or to think of other people as being the them, and then the other them, who is those on top, can make people think that it's the other people, that it's the people at the bottom that are having problems with each other. And so conceptually, it's basically like you can see that the powers that be have really manipulated people psychologically, and they've used their own tendencies against them. And the real power of the system is not that it has fabricated a psychology that doesn't exist, but it has manipulated those things which are innate to our existence as human beings. It has manipulated those against us.
Exactly. Well put. I believe you're absolutely right. And also this war on human nature, really, where they're working against our most natural, you know, fundamental principles. And this is, of course, is causing a tremendous, you know, friction between different groups. And, of course, I understand that regard. You know, conservatism of trying to conserve some of these values. The problem, again, politically, is, of course, that they're not trying to conserve anything today. Today, it's like they're just playing, you know, catch-up to progressivism, and we're running off the side of the cliff, and no one knows where we're going. So the point is that the political system that we have today, be that in America or Europe, or I would say, I haven't been to every country in the world, but I'd say basically all around the world there are failures in the political and economic systems, but it doesn't cater to the needs of people and the different needs that people have. But so how would you suggest to begin something like this? Are you guys proposing, you know, the formulation of new political parties? Is there an ideological change that have to be made? Is this solely on a level of dialogue now in the beginning? Or how do you see this? How should the transformation take place for these different sides to understand each other?
In the United States, because there is no viable political solution, there are no legal mechanisms, right, in which you can start a third party. We already saw, you know, we've already learned, we've already been through what happened with the Independent Party, Libertarian Party, Green Party, Peace and Freedom Party. None of these could ever launch or find any footing because of the monopolistic hegemonic control that the one-party state in the U.S. has. The United States is a dictatorship. It is a one-party state that claims to have two parties. But it is not even a duopoly. Ever since the Clinton period, at least, they have transformed this into one. So we must first identify the problem. The most important thing is to shake people of any illusions that there will be a process on the federal level of elections. Now, people should form small groups and networks, and they can influence in the level of city politics, municipal politics. In those areas, there are some real basis for electoral struggle. But on the broader picture, people are already networking. People are already absorbing different ideas. You know, people on the left who saw a problem with capitalism are also seeing how, and people who have lived lives, you know, are seeing that their own experiences are very, very different from leftist discourse. And likewise, people who might who have seen themselves on the right as conservatives, who had a different set of values, have seen how some of the conclusions that have been made for them are also not accurate at all. You know, that we are living in a society, even though we are individuals and we are responsible for our decisions, there is a truth to sociology, and people do not always have free will, and we're not necessarily rational calculators. We are also driven by our emotions, and so the idea that people are equipped necessarily and are able to make rational decisions as if in a vacuum is not true. And people on the right are seeing that if people can be manipulated on the left, they can also be manipulated on the right. And so I think people have become more frustrated with the whole discourse. So to answer your question, Henrik, what the solutions are and what that looks like is, yes, first, it's already happening. So we just have to look at we don't have to propose any new or radical model. These processes are already taking place. Media from other countries in English language, whether it's the Iranian Press TV or Russian RT, are already gaining popularity in the U.S. People more and more are already looking for their favorite bloggers or YouTube channels to get analysis of what's really going on. And a whole series of things have happened, starting with 9/11 and moving forward to all of these weird hoaxes. I mean, Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon. And there are just millions and millions of people, I mean, countless tens of millions of Americans who see right through this. And part of developing this dialogue and building this movement is to get a little bit past some of the cultural hang-ups in the U.S. There are some cultural hang-ups in the U.S. that relate to politeness. And there's a psychological mechanism where people wrongly perceive the official view to be the most commonly held view. And the more and more that people talk through social networking, Twitter, Facebook, on internet forums, they're getting a confidence in themselves, and they're starting to realize that they aren't the ones who are crazy and that their views are not the minority views but rather the majority views.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really interesting sometimes when you look at some of the comment fields and things like that on articles, and I'm just like, whoa, some people are actually on the ball, you know, even these mainstream papers and stuff, and people are out there talking, and it feels like the environment that we get from the media, this very just over, I don't know, political correctness and hyperdrive and this insanity, is like, people don't think like that anymore. It's just this image that they're trying to impose on. Maybe there's journalists out there and really indoctrinated people, but I think people are sick and tired of it. They're looking for some kind of stability, some kind of resurgence, I think, of traditional values on top of this, because it's like this castle, this house of cards that we're building here, I don't think is going to last in the long run, you know?
Yes. I mean, really from the left, we can understand that their criticism of corporate structures and of government's alliance with corporations and to place as a human value the profits among all things. But one of the problems of the left is that they had a vision of the future which actually took some of the foundations of the system for granted. And so they agreed, one of the problems on the far left is that they agreed with the dominant paradigm that people are essentially statistics, and that we are just material populations. And that, in fact, the very things that the left was supporting in many spheres were precisely those things which the capitalists, if you will, were benefiting from. So, for example, the destruction of the nuclear family, the Marxists strongly argued that this was inevitable and therefore desirable. And so they had this sort of twisted view of progress in which the things that capitalism was doing and that benefited from were somehow paving the way for a better future, when in fact it was just creating more and more of a dystopia. And so, and this is, I think, a very interesting subject theoretically, but what in fact we have seen is that the very same things that progressives promoted, once the people themselves went through those systems, they saw something else. And as a piece of anecdota, for example, I went to public schools My family was not particularly wealthy, and I went to I'm myself Latino. I went to a multi-ethnic desegregated school because desegregation was mandated by law. And so everybody was like, we had 30% Latino, 30% white, 30% black, and 10% Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, and other. And so these are the stats. And what happened is on the schoolyard, even though like we'd be friendly with each other, and you know, there was rarely any violence or fights or enmity, but at lunchtime the kids basically segregated themselves.
Yeah.
And in the classroom was desegregated, and kids didn't sit by race, and seats were not assigned, but they didn't. But people did not self-segregate when they were in a mandated system. There was no really, unless people were best friends and happened to be of the same race, they didn't really sit together by any racial category. But kids were being told that they were all equal. But, you know, some kids, whether they were black, Asian, white, whatever, some kids were smarter than other kids.
That's just how it is. Just how it's going to be.
How it is. So this leftist idea that everyone is equally endowed, I mean, there were black kids or Asian kids in my classes that were just heads and shoulders above anyone else. And this had to do with the fact that they were born that way or something else. But, what really matters is that even by the age of 5 or 7 years old, these differences are already expressed. And so whether they're environmental or not is not even so important, because no one would suggest that it is a good thing that you take children away from their parents at birth and put them into institutions. So people are going to come from families. Different families have different experiences, so on and so forth. And so what people who came through progressively derived institutions, whether it was public education or desegregation, found is that there are natural hierarchies and people self-segregate in their leisure time. That's just what happened.
That's a very important point. It's a vital one, and it's one I want to return to a little bit here in the second segment, Joaquin, as we continue here in a bit. And I have much more to ask you, many more things. We've really just kind of scraped the surface a bit here. But let's just spend some time talking about the different websites and, of course, where people can find more information about you and your different groups. You have, I guess, three out of the gates we could mention. As we said, the Center for Syncretic Studies, but you also have Open Revolt and New Resistance. And do let me know if there's any more to that. But please give us the websites and all that, Joaquin.
Yeah, okay, well, thankfully, all of these are Google-optimized, so if you just search them Google, it'll be the first hit. For people who are really interested in getting analysis from leading analysts, bloggers, sociologists, and political thinkers from Russia, but who read English, the only site to go to is Fort Russ. And Fort Russ, F-O-R-T space R-U-S-S, if you Google that, it's the first or second hit. And my colleague, Christina Karlova, works day and night translating the best stuff from the Russian language and putting it on Fort Russ.
Oh, great.
And,
yeah.
Open Revolt is the website, the web hub of New Resistance. It's the communication ideological arm of New Resistance. And, of course, New Resistance is a loose network of North and South American political activists, thinkers. We include non-dogmatic people from the radical left and the right, anti-capitalist, small business, people against neoliberal economic policies, and we're deeply involved in this discourse and also building a movement. And the Center for Syncretic Studies, I work for in Belgrade. We're an NGO, a think tank. We're a public think tank, and we produce and reproduce article, scholarly, peer-reviewed, journal-type documents produced either exclusively for us or are sent to us by the authors. And we're engaged in the political scene in Serbia, which, as we talked about at the top of the hour, was going to be a central place of action moving forward.
Well, definitely. Much more to talk with you about, Joaquin. Many interesting subjects. We'll definitely get into talking more about Russia and the Ukraine a little bit later as well. I know you've written quite extensively on this, so much more to discuss here. But we'll take a short break here, folks. And, of course, as we always do, we'll have the links up to the websites that we've been talking about here on redeyescreations.com. So click through from our website in case you don't want to go out and search for it. Easy from there. All right, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more, ladies and gentlemen. When we return with the second hour with Joaquin Flores, we'll continue to speak more about contrived equality, ethnic differences, natural leadership, and hierarchy. What happens when governments force globalism and multiculturalism on ethnically homogenous cultures? And why does segregation occur naturally in places like America if it's so great? We'll also talk more about the situation in the Ukraine and Russia. Joaquin will talk more about fourth generation warfare, and how what he calls holographic realities are constructed with the aid of the media. Basically, people are living in false realities, a simulacrum, a completely fabricated mental space with no connection to the real world. Later, we talk about the cult of PC, Islam in Europe, generational warfare theory, and a whole lot more. A lot of interesting concepts are presented coming up here in the second hour, so don't miss it. Go to redeyesmembers.com. Sign up and join us if you're not yet a member and learn something new. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have much more upcoming on Red Eyes Radio. We have Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki next. After this, we have Jay Dyer, Laird Scranton, the Swedish Surveyor, Patrick Henningsen, Marion Van Court, John Lash, and a little bit later, we have Dennis Fetcho, Jeff Gates, and Allison Weir. For now, we say thank you for listening, but please stay with us. Much more is coming up shortly, right after the break.